Judge Larkin has resolved her internet difficulties. I apologize for the inconvenience. The next case we're hearing this morning, July 28th, 2020, at the Minnesota Court of Appeals remotely, is Kent versus Kent. Each side will have 15 minutes for primary argument. Appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal argument. Please be mindful of the timing device that is displayed on your screen by the marshal. Also, if a judge has questions, she will speak up or perhaps wave her hand to get your attention, so please be watching for that. Who is appearing on behalf of appellant this morning?
Greg Engel, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Engel, you may begin with your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. If it may please the court, the respondent in this case acquired ownership interest in four companies while the parties were married. JK Real Estate, JK Self Storage, Benton Development, and Motors and More. Petitioner is opposed to the trial court's non-marital determination of two of these companies and the valuation of all four companies. JK Real Estate, the court used an Exhibit 70, which is a QuickBooks interim balance sheet, as a valuation of JK Real Estate. No one submitted this document or testified that the document represented the value of the business. In fact, respondent presented no valuation of the business and instead argued that his entire ownership was not marital. Petitioner, however, submitted the fair market value of assets of the business to establish the net asset value going forward. For instance, petitioner documented that and proved that JK Real Estate owned 96,806 shares of IREIT stock. This is a stock that's publicly traded on the New York.
Mr. Engel, if I may, this is Judge Jessen. So before you're diving into the value of JK Real Estate, but if, and I understand you disagree with this, if the district court is correct that the respondent overcame the presumption of marital privilege so that this is non-marital property, then we only get to the valuation issue, don't we, if the husband, if the respondent actively participated in the management of that of JK Real Estate. At least I think I'm saying that because you cited in your brief Swick versus Swick. And the district court here said there was no evidence of that. So if there's no evidence he actively participated, do we get into the evaluation issues? Because then we don't need to arguably address whether there was an increase in value that your client gets. Are you following me? I understand it's a complicated question.
I follow it exactly. We do have a little bit of a bad connection here, but if I can explain, the court found that the increase in the value of JK Real Estate was marital increase. So it made a finding that there was a gift, but then the increase was marital, but it went on to find that the increased value of the company at the date of valuation was zero. So we're arguing that the value was more than zero and relying on the court's conclusion that the increase was marital. At Benton Development, the other company, he found that the increase was non-marital. So that is a different argument with regards to, was there a gift, and then was the increase in the value of that company passive or active, or how come it increased, and how respondent had a responsibility in that increase. But for JK Real Estate, I believe the court found that the increase was marital.
Okay, so it's a difference between with Benton Development, then my question is more relevant there. Do we reach the value issue where there's a finding that it wasn't attributable to his efforts? Are we on the same page?
Yes.
Or is that? Okay, thank you.
And to reiterate, the court used the same valuation basically of both JK Real Estate and Benton Development. It used a QuickBooks interim balance sheet. And for instance, a publicly traded stock on a New York Stock Exchange, we documented that stock was worth $591,000. However, the interim balance sheet listed the stock at $12,000.
So if I may, Mr. Engel, on that note, once again, assuming that the district court is correct and the respondent has, you know, overcome the marital presumption, so this is non-marital property, whose burden is it to show the value of the companies? for this evaluation? Is that yours or is that was that respondent's? Because the court doesn't address that explicitly. And I think where we have a district court that's saying no one submitted an appraisal of the value, then that becomes relevant. Whose burden was it?
The case law talks about the value of the company is the fair market value of the assets of the company. Nardini says that sets a floor for what you can value the company. So what petitioner did in this trial was submitted the fair market value of the assets of the company, which would have established a floor value for the company. The court said that the interim balance sheet was a book value and said it's using a book value. One, nobody testified that the interim balance sheet represented a book value. And case law that we cited in our brief said fair market value is controlling over book value and valuing of assets and companies. So the book value, such as publicly traded stock, where the fair market value, according to the experts who testified, is $591,000, and the interim balance sheet listed at $12,000, there's clearly a difference between the interim balance sheet, which the court said was the book value of the stock, versus stock that's traded on the New York Stock Exchange. The same was proven for the tax assessed value of the real estate versus the book value. If you look at the interim...
But my question was simply more, who has the burden of proving the value? Is that you, your client, or respondent?
I don't know if there's a burden. If it's a marital asset, I would say that the owner of the asset has the burden of showing what the value is. He didn't, the respondent owns the company. He didn't present any value at all of what the value of his company was. So the petitioner had no choice but to have the assets of the company presented to the court to say this is what the values of these are. So I believe the burden would be on the owner of the asset, but the petitioner still presented documentation to prove that the market value of the assets and what they were. Our problem is the court saying, I'm going to use a book value to value a corporation. And so he took this interim balance sheet and he called it a book value. If you look at the exhibit talks about the properties that the company owned, which was real estate. And so, but it depreciates those. The interim balance sheet depreciates the real estate. However, the tax assessed values don't go down every year because of depreciation of the value of the property. And thus, appraisals, the experts said appraisals of the real estate takes precedent. The tax assessed value is fine. You can use those if you don't have actual appraisals. So when the experts appraised the other businesses, they used the tax assessed values where they didn't have appraisals. The court ignored all that and used interim balance sheets and called them book values. So that we find cited in our brief is a legal error to use those valuations when fair market value controls. If I may move on with regards to Benton Development, the court determined that this was a non-marital gift. However, there was no documentation whatsoever documenting the gift. The respondent testified that his mother started the company in 1999 and he received his ownership in 2001. However, petitioner got the corporation books and documented exactly how Benton Development was performed. In July of 1999, respondent signed a purchase agreement for some land, only him. This land eventually became Benton Development. He then worked with an attorney to get clear title to this land because it was held up in the lady's estate. And that document is in there. None of these documents were disputed. In November 2010, he then transfers his personal purchase agreement on the land into Benton Development. And then he, on December 16, 1999, he signs as organizer and files with the Secretary of State the documentation to organize and form Benton Development LLC. On the same day, he as organizer then appoints the first board of directors and he elects himself as president and chief manager. He then, the Benton Development as a company, takes out a loan to purchase the land that he put into the purchase agreement into the company. And all the partners have to personally guarantee that note that the company has taken out. The court never explains when the so-called gift of his ownership in Benton Development began. However, because we proved by the documentation that the ownership of this company was established by respondent, and he was the owner from day one, even the membership control agreement says he was the owner from day one, he could not have received his share of that company as a gift from his mother. He formed it, he was the owner, it was formed, he and his mother in the membership control agreement were undivided 50% owners. So the burden of proof that there was a gift is on the respondent. His testimony, which was found to be inaccurate, and we cited four or five different times when he said how he obtained a gift here, none of those were proven to be true. They were all false. He started this company and he was an owner from day one. Thus, he was running the company. After they formed the company, he built the storage units on the land that is now that what this company produces as income. It's a storage unit facility.
Mr. Engel, if I may, just in light of the time, turn to another issue I had a question about, unless there's something you want to do to wrap up this part of your argument.
No.
I wanted to ask about your argument about the allocation of debt regarding Motors and More. You said it was wrong to allocate the $300,000 promissory note. The district judge said there's no evidence at trial linking that promissory note to the liability on the company's books. So from your perspective, where was that evidence at trial that made that link?
And we spell that out pretty clearly in our brief, but the link doesn't need to be made because the respondent admitted both in testimony and in his reply brief that they are the same debt. So that should end the argument right there. It's like saying, as I said in Benton Development, if the parties personally guaranteed a note from the company, you can't say the company owes the note and double dip and say the people also personally guarantee it, so they owe the note also. The debt, the $300,000 Motors and More, the respondent testified this money went into Motors and More as a contribution, and that he then obtained shares of Motors and More based on these funds. It also shows Motors and More was paying the interest on this note $2,000 a month, because it's at 8%, we showed the note, every month. It comes out of Motors and More's funds, paying down for this $300,000 debt. The debt is, the court then said, Motors and More is worth zero because it has all these debts, one being this $300,000, one being this $220,000 debt to Lisa, the petitioner, who also, it was showed through her non-marital funds into Motors and More. So the appraiser said Motors and More is worth zero because of this one of these debt. The court then took that same debt and put it on respondent's personal side of the equation of the asset. And when we said that's double dipping, the court said you never linked the two. However, respondent did link the two, so did petitioner, so did the documentation, that said these are the same debt. There was no testimony or evidence that there was ever two $300,000 debts to Travis Moore. It was only one. And the respondent says, well, there is only one. It is the same debt, but what does that matter? He should get credit on both the company books and his personal accounting. With regards to dissipation of assets, that was a contentious issue because during the divorce action, the petitioner kept selling off or receiving funds on properties and not accounting for them. We went to court four to five times, and finally the court ordered him to disclose what he had all sold during the divorce action. He disclosed what he sold, but he didn't disclose where the money went. One of the big ones was there was a eminent domain action by Stearns County, and they paid them $504,000. They took those funds, they paid off some debt with it, and the remaining $354,000 was missing. The accountant said they're doing a 1033 exchange. That means they can hang on to the funds and they don't have to account for where they deposit them for 3 years. It's not like a 1031 exchange where they can't touch the funds. A 1033, they get the funds. They have 3 years to dispose of them. The trial was in that three-year period of time. So the accountant said, I don't know what they did with the money. It's somewhere. And then he said, you asked me for where these funds were 4 to 5 times. They're somewhere, basically, was his testimony. They were not accounted for. They're still missing. They also, while this pending was pending, sold a property for $1 million. Now, this was listed on the interim balance sheet for JK Real Estate at $357,000. We said, well, where's $1 million? It went unaccounted for. We have a contract for deed sold for $850,000. We accounted for some of it.
Mr. Engel, this is Judge Larkin. Your time for primary argument has expired. You'll have 5 minutes on rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay.
Who is appearing for respondent this morning? Oops, I think you're muted.
Tim Reuter.
All right. Mr. Reuter, you may proceed with your argument.
Very well. I only have a brief argument. I think the court's order was fairly detailed. I'm just going to point to the two questions asked by your honors and leave the rest, the balance of my time, for questions. We have a very detailed order before your honors to review the issue with regards to JK Real Estate Services. The court has 4 pages in its findings addressing how it came to its conclusions. The analysis or argument by the appellant on this issue is somewhat moot because the court determined the property had a negative value of slightly over $1 million and some change, and there's negative capital accounts. There is no way to equalize or find enough value or property in this account to make the argument proffered by the appellant meritorious of a discussion. With regards to the Motors and More debt, the Motors and More debt is an exhibit very clearly identified. It is a debt owed by the Kents individually. It is immaterial that the Kents then use that money to put it into the business known as Motors and More, because that business has so much negative liabilities that it clearly offsets its assets. It's another red herring to address to your honors that the appellant's mere disappointment with the order rather than errors of the order. It is clear from the valuation, the business evaluation of Motors and More, it had no value. Its liabilities far exceeded its assets. And the court correctly assessed the debt to my client's father, and therefore that finding was appropriate, and this entire argument was brought once again before the district court judge, who then deemed that that issue is not meritorious to change his findings. I yield the balance of my time for whatever questions your honors have, because I understand this is a 16-issue challenge, and that will lead to many questions for yourselves. Thank you.
Judge Jessen, do you have questions?
Yes, Mr. Reuter. So I just wanted to ask you a couple of questions first about spousal maintenance, which you didn't address extensively in your brief. But I could have some concerns that the lower court did not make any findings regarding the marital standard of living, and also did not make findings about the amount of monthly income that could be generated by the appellant's property settlement without invading the principal. Don't we have to remand for additional findings?
Well, the court issued findings on most of the, he went through a complete analysis in his findings on that subject, outlining the statutory criteria for maintenance. I believe with that analysis and the court's findings that some maintenance was necessary, that a remand is not necessary. I think the court went through the parties' incomes, and it may not have explicitly had said that, but to come up with the dollar value the court did, there clearly was an analysis by the court to come up with that dollar value. So I'm not sure a remand is necessary because the court does address the factors for addressing spousal maintenance. Thank you.
And what about the not making findings about the amount of monthly income generated by the property settlement. I mean, just given the Curtis case and that holding. Do you have anything you'd like to add about that?
Well, the income generated by the property settlement, that would only benefit, the appellant would have more income by that property settlement. That would just decrease the amount of maintenance in this case, unless I'm misunderstanding the question. Because the property settlement awarded to the appellant would generate income, from my understanding.
Yes, and then my understanding, but correct me if you disagree with me, based upon the Curtis case, then when we're just saying how much income did appellant have available, you'd look at the monthly income generated, not the overall property settlement amount as being available to meet her monthly expenses.
Right, and I think the court in its analysis kind of did that. That's how it came up with its dollar amount, is that it assessed that given her income and went through the expenses and assessed those expenses. It didn't explicitly point that out, and I concede that to your honors, but I think to come up with the property settlement amount that it did, it had to do that analysis. I that's all I can say on that subject.
Okay, I did have one additional question, and that was about the withdrawal by your client of, I think it was about $211,000 from JK Self Storage in 2017. There wasn't any analysis by the district court about why some of that was not awarded to the wife. Could you just give me some background about that? That sure. Just raised red flags to me.
Sure. And that's the red herrings that are being argued by the appellant. I mean, the issue before the court is, what's the interest in this business venture? The fact of the matter is that Mr. Kent has a minority interest in every business venture. And during the course of time, there may have been withdrawals, but that was counted as distributions to him. The marital interest in this property is what's the overall value of its shares, which the evaluator determined as well as the court analyzed. It's not a dollar for dollar equation. It's a different case than if Mr. Kent had sole interest in this business. The fact of the matter is that each withdrawal that he makes, he then gets a distribution to that amount, and you have to equalize their capital accounts. The evaluator reviewed all the transactions from regard to this business entity and determined that Mr. Kent's ownership shares is X dollars. We can go through different transactions about that, but I think that's kind of a red herring, because it's not a dollar for dollar equation, because the value of the business entity has to take into account liabilities.
One final question, if I may. I think I'm sure you were paying attention when I was asking Mr. Engel about whose burden of proof is it to establish the value of the business, where, assuming that the correct decision was that it was non-marital property. Do you have a case you could cite or a position on that? I did not see that explicitly addressed in either of your briefing.
Yeah, it wasn't specifically addressed in either's briefings. The fact of the matter is that the court concluded that it was a non-marital interest, and then it would be the burden of both petitioner and the respondent if they deemed that there was a value to conclude. The court had the business records of these entities, and the court used those business records to determine a value for that entity, and that's how the court came with the negative value and the negative capital account values. But I don't have a case offhand to address that, Your Honor. I apologize.
Any additional questions from the panel?
No, Judge Jessen asked my questions. Thank you.
Okay. Any closing remarks, or does that conclude your argument, Mr. Ritter?
That will conclude my argument. I think the order speaks for itself. Thank you.
All right, then. Mr. Engel, would you like to have 5 minutes for a rebuttal argument?
I would, Your Honor. Thank you.
You may proceed.
With regards to the burden of proof on a non-marital claim, value is on the person making that claim. We did cite that in our brief with some case law that supports that. So the respondent had the burden to show that the that the increase in the value of the property was passive versus active, that he didn't have any import and thus non-marital, otherwise it's presumed to be marital. With regards to other questions raised, there was something in regards to the debt or using Exhibit 70 as a valuation of JK Real Estate. He indicated that the book value was zero or the turn. It included a debt to Wells Fargo of $1.3 million, which we documented and evidence undisputedly showed was paid off. That was satisfied. It was satisfied with the refinancing with Deer Wood Bank. They took the loan out of Deer Wood and paid off Wells Fargo $1.3 million. Both Deer Wood and Wells Fargo show up of over $1 million on the liability side. Also, there is a debt to iRent listed as $2.55 million, which both the bookkeeper and the expert and the accountant all testified that is not a debt that's been satisfied. It stays on the books, but it's not a debt that the company ever has to pay. It's been satisfied, and we even had letters from iRent, the company, a publicly traded company, and it indicated that the liability was gone. So using all the figures in one document and making a determination that that is a fair market value contradicts all the evidence that we submitted about what the value of these properties are. With regards to the court's question on removing $211,000 extra out of a corporation, what happens is if you put $200,000 into a corporation, your capital account will say the company, you have $200,000 in your capital account, meaning the first $200,000 you take out is tax-free because that's what you put in. If you don't put any money in and you take $200,000 out, your capital account will be negative. It will mean you owe that money back to the company. However, it's not a taxable event. The IRS doesn't make you pay taxes on that money coming out because it looks at it kind of like a loan from the company. Well, if you look at the tax returns, respondents' capital accounts in these companies that he has a 50% ownership is like $500,000 negative. He is cleaning money out of these accounts, selling our property during the marriage here, and not accounting for where these funds have gone. For instance, that 1033 exchange, if you look on the balance sheet that a court used in the valuation, he puts that as a minus $300,000 or a liability on his balance sheet because he has the funds. They're in his hands. They haven't been accounted for. And the accountant says they don't have to be accounted for. So it's a juggling of assets in these corporations. But the bottom line is he's not a minority shareholder, by the way. He is a 50% owner with his mother in two of these companies. Motors and More, he has a 33% ownership. And then Benton Development, the one that he organized and formed, he's a 25% owner. But he, as a 50% owner, he controls buying and selling of land, of property. And the fact that they continued to sell off without permission or even disclosing what they were doing during this divorce action of millions and millions of dollars of real estate, has never been accounted for. The fact that she only received $168,000 in property and it was used against her in the maintenance, the court also said of that award, the $168,000, he can pay that off at $2,000 a month. So what part of that $2,000 then is property and what part is income generating to help her pay her expenses when not documented? The court seemed to be confused about this because even in the trial, you'll see the award, it said you were awarded the furniture in the house. And I said, that's not relevant. How is that relevant? And Mr. Reuter said, it's relevant to maintenance. And the court said, overruled your objection. She can talk about it. And then he cites that she's awarded like her house, which has a debt, her furniture, and those type of assets that clearly are not generating income for maintenance purposes, but the court puts those in the maintenance calculation to figure a maintenance.
Does that conclude your argument, counsel?
It does. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to the attorneys. The matter is well briefed and well argued. The case is now submitted. You'll have a decision within 90 days. Thank you. That concludes the hearing.
Thank you.